And as I mentioned, we got into some interesting discussions of this particular section as we're talking about Christ as high priest, beginning in verse 14. So if you will, read with me 14 through 16 again, and we'll just make a few more comments before we get into the questions. Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. So the text, beginning in verse 14, discusses Christ as high priest. And of course, as we have indicated, this entire epistle is a series of contrasts between what was found in the Old Covenant, what is found in the New, and that the New is superior to the Old. That is certainly the case with regard to the priesthood. And in fact, in the next several chapters, we're going to be discussing in some depth the nature of the priesthood and the distinctions or differences between the priesthood of Christ, the order of Melchizedek, and the priesthood of Aaron, which was the priesthood that existed under the old law. He refers to Jesus as a great high priest. The term there, great, having reference to the nature of his position. In other words, in contrast to other high priests, he is a great high priest. It has reference to where he serves in that capacity. He has passed through the heavens, which we indicated is an indication of his ascension into heaven, that he is at the right hand of the Father and his throne. You'll notice in verse 16 of the text, he says, therefore let us come boldly to the throne of grace. Now the nature of Christ as high priest, you'll notice in chapter 5 and verse 2, just to go forward a few verses, it says that he can have compassion on those who are ignorant and going astray, since he himself is also subject to weakness. He actually, that is a good thing that we'll begin discussing pretty quickly, the qualifications for the high priest and why he serves or how he serves in that capacity. But in verse 15, we are told that Jesus is an appropriate high priest for us because he can sympathize with our weaknesses. He was tempted in all points like as we. But he did so without sinning. So we discussed last week the fact that Jesus, in serving as high priest, was tempted. But that when we talk about the temptation of Jesus, we do not want to indicate from that his proclivity was to sin. He was a sinless individual. God, when he sent his son to the earth, had confidence in Jesus and was sure of what would be accomplished, and that is the salvation of mankind through his redemptive sacrifice. In order for that to be accomplished, Jesus had to live a sinless life, and there was no doubt that he would. And yet, as a man, he was enticed by Satan, as are we all. The, of course, greatest example of that in the New Testament is his temptation in the wilderness. But I would also make note of the great trial as he neared the end of his life that was seen in his prayer to God as he was in the Garden of Gethsemane before his betrayal. At that point in time, in the recognition of what was required of him, you'll remember he said, let this cup pass from me if it be possible. But in the same breath, he said, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. And an indication, again, of how hard it was and how desirous he was of not having to go through with the sacrifice. But the willingness to do God's will was ever present with Jesus. And so the reason why Christ can sympathize with us is because he's been through it as well. He knows what temptation is. He suffered temptation himself. But having said that, again, I don't want to indicate from that that Jesus nearly sinned, or that God's scheme of redemption was at a precarious place at any point in Jesus' life, which is kind of a picture that we see not only among brethren, but it certainly is one that we see in portrayals, dramatic portrayals and such that have become so popular in our day. There are a number of movies that are out there that portray Jesus as almost a bumbling fool or an individual who is on the edge of and tortured and about to give up his mission or work on earth. And then some that even advocate that Jesus, in effect, was a sinner. Take issue with the idea of his sinlessness. So, we need to recognize the nature of Jesus does not coincide with that picture, but it does indicate very clearly that he can sympathize with us because of what he suffered, as do we. He is, his lot was common to man in that he suffered temptation. Now, having said all of that, because Jesus can sympathize with us because of his temptation on earth, when we approach God, we can approach God with confidence and the assurance that we will receive mercy and grace during our time of need because he is there as a mediator. He is there as one who makes appeal to God as high priest, as did the high priest in the time of the Old Covenant. Again, as we get into chapter 5, we'll see some description of this, where we see what the high priest were to do and what their work was. But suffice to say, as indicated in verse 16 of the text, Jesus, as a result of his position as high priest, is there in heaven at the right hand of the Father and able to make intercession on our behalf when we approach that throne of grace. Now, what obviously is indicated here in this text is that we approach the throne of grace through prayer. So we are making petitions to God, and the way in which we do that today is through prayer. When we make petitions to God, if you'll note our form in public worship, when we offer up prayers to God, we offer them in the name of Jesus. So we are praying to the Father through the Son, and he serves as mediator for us in the office of high priest. And it is stated very clearly in verse 16 that when we come boldly to the throne of grace, we, through that, may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. One of the phrases that is used in one translation is during seasonal needs, times of need, seasonal needs. In other words, there are times when a special grace or a special mercy is needed. I remember in our discussions on Wednesday evening that Justin made the point. This text here in chapter 5 and verse 16 is a good one to turn to indicate the possibility of apostasy, because the idea of mercy indicates that there is something that is amiss. If a person is in need of mercy, mercy is not something that is needed by one who merits or earns a particular position. Mercy is needed for the one who is, who has fallen short, there is something that is amiss, and as a result of that, he is in need of some mercy. We make a distinction when we talk about the law of the land. You have justice and then you have mercy. If you have a merciful judge may take a note of circumstances in a particular situation where a crime was committed, and because of these circumstances may be more lenient or may forgive the offense, where the law itself would require that or the law itself would give guidelines as to some punishment. That's mercy. Justice may say one thing, but mercy another. So when we talk about grace, of course, ultimately we're talking about that sacrifice of Jesus on the cross that is the final or the ultimate extension of that grace. But there are times as we have sinned before God in our Christian lives that we are in need, as we pray, for forgiveness of those sins. And And as a result of this prayer and Christ making petition on our behalf, that mercy and grace is offered to us that we might receive that forgiveness. And so it is because of who Christ is and because of the position that he holds and where he holds it that we can boldly approach God in prayer with that assurance, with that confidence, that because of who he is, when we make such petitions, through his intercessory work, we can obtain what we're desiring, and that is forgiveness and help when we need that help, which we do from time to time. So, the high priest under the priesthood of Aaron, they would offer up the sacrifices on behalf of the people as one sympathetic to their plight because he himself is a man. When we offer up prayers to God in the new covenant, we can be bold in so doing because of the position Christ holds as our high priest. He is empathetic to us, and he is capable of petitioning God on our behalf. And so it is an effective means of obtaining the mercies that we desire and seek. All right? So that's basically what I had to share with you with regard to the 16th verse. Does anyone have any comments, questions to add to that before we get into our review questions? Yes, Dick.
And we can see the significance of Jesus being our high priest. Well, if he was our high priest, we couldn't even go to God in prayer. And Paul just wants us to approach the throne of God boldly. And an example is, remember in the book of Esther, when Haman or whatever was trying to retaliate the Jews, and Mordecai came to Esther being the queen, you need to petition the king. And she said, well, I can't go to him unless he gives it okay, and he had said, I'd come to him, you know, like that. And so important way, this is probably why he said, God made a queen, so if I die, I die, you know. But we don't have to worry about that, because we can approach God boldly through Jesus, and we don't have fear of that. We will be rejected as long as we're faithful to the whole counsel of God.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting point, and I would suppose that you said that this example of Esther would be a good illustration of that principle. The actual process of the high priest's approach to God under the Old Covenant is another example of this. During the Old Covenant, access to God was very limited. You'll remember that that there were a couple of occasions where Moses had kind of a face-to-face with God as the lawgiver. Under the Old Covenant, there was a great limitation that was placed upon access with regard to the holiest of holies, which is, of course, in this Jewish law, significant in that that is the place that represents God's presence in the tabernacle first and then in the temple. And as far as the most holy place, that holiest of holies, it was allowed for man to enter that place only once in a year. And if you look at the actual ministrations of the high priest, because only the high priest was allowed to enter that, the ministrations of the high priest on that occasion was very, very short. He didn't spend a lot of time in this location. And when you go through the Old Testament and you find reasoning given for this limited access, again and again and again you hear the phrase, something along the lines of, before the people I must appear as holy. And this is an indication of the sanctification of the place, of the respect that God demanded. This was not to be something that this idea of access to God that was commonplace or easily attained, and so there was a very severe restrictions. And this is another point that is being made here. There's a distinction between what was allowed under the Old Covenant, where men were limited in their access to God because of His holiness and His standing. And even the high priest, in their sinfulness, were only allowed to be present there for a short period of time once a year. Now, under the new covenant of grace, access to God is freely given and encouraged. And in contrast to the approach that was made, which was cautious and minimal under the old covenant, now there is a bold approach that is offered to men under that new covenant as a result of Christ's sacrifice. So it's a neat thing to see that, and it has nothing to do with the change in men, but rather a change in covenant and a change in standing as a result of that. It is because of what Christ accomplished. That's the emphasis that is being placed here. It's because of who Christ is in contrast to the high priest under the Levitical priesthood. It is because of what Christ accomplished in his sinless life and sacrificial death in contrast to the sinfulness and even as we get into the discussion of the high priesthood, we'll see that the priesthood of Melchizedek is an order without genealogy, without beginning or end. So Christ reigns as high priest forever, in contrast to the limited duration of any particular high priest under the Aaronic priesthood. So in all these ways, Christ is superior, and because of his superior person, position, sacrifice, abilities, now our access to God is much more favorable and much more available than it was any time previous as a result of these things. So it's again, what we emphasize and what we encourage you to do is, as we discuss these things, to recognize why it is then, as these things are read, that we have it better than they did, because that's the intent of the writer in all these examples given, is to explain how much better we have it than what they had it in the old covenant. All right, anybody else? Okay, then let us quickly go over the discussion questions. We don't want to spend a great deal of time. Again, it turns out is that in our studies we've been doing a pretty good job of covering the material that we want to. But this is a way of reviewing before we get into the next chapter. So the first discussion question is, what does the 95th Psalm in verse 11 do to the idea that the rest referred to for God's people has its only and ultimate fulfillment in entrance to Canaan? Now, this was a view that that the Jews might hold, that the rest that was referred to concerning Joshua and the promises given, that would be found ultimately in the land of Canaan. Now, the 95th Psalm, just to go over there very quickly, which is alluded to in our text, sometimes my pages seem to stick together these days. 95 in verse 11 states. Oh, okay. So let's start off with verse 8 and go through verse 11, where the psalmist is again referring to those people who were in rebellion. He says, "Don't harden your hearts as in the rebellion, as in the day of trial in the wilderness when your fathers tested me. They tried me, though they saw my work. 40 years I was grieved with that generation and said, it's a people who go astray in their hearts and they do not know my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest." You'll notice that phrase there. They shall not enter my rest. And you'll note the parallel of that starting with about verse 7. As he's talking about in verse 8, he says, again in this place, they shall not enter my rest. Talking about verse 3, I swore in my wrath they shall not enter our rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. He was referring there to the Sabbath day, resting on the seventh. And then spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way, that God rested from his seventh day from all his works. And again in this place, they shall not enter our rest. And he says in verse 6, since therefore it remains that some must enter it, and those to whom it was first preached did not enter because of disobedience, again he designates a certain day, saying in David, today, after such a long time as it's been said, today if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua, now this is the key in verses 8 and 9, if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. There remains therefore a rest for the people of God. So the idea is, you have Psalm 95, 11 that is mentioned a number of times there in Hebrews chapter 4, beginning in verse 3 or so and going through verse 9. What is true with regard to that? Maybe I didn't do a very good job of it because I'm confusing myself when I look at the question again. But let me ask it this way. Does the text indicate that the rest has been attained ultimately? We'll just do it. it that way so I don't confuse anybody further. Let's answer that. Has the rest of God's people been ultimately attained yet? Okay, according to verse 9, no, right? There are indications of rest, God's rest on the Sabbath day, the call for the Jews to rest, the promise of rest entering into Canaan, but there is a reference that was made by Joshua as he spoke of another day of rest. And so in verse 9, the conclusion is, there remains therefore a rest for the people of God. Those who are obedient to God have a rest yet remaining. Now, this is the important question. Question number 2, what is the rest that remains? What's under consideration there? Heaven, eternity in heaven is the idea. So again, having said that, what's the significance? Why is he bringing this up? If they went back to the old covenant, where would the rest be found? Under the old law. What's the extent of that rest? It would be entrance into the land of Canaan. All that you have to look forward to if you go back is what was attained as they crossed over the Jordan. But Joshua indicated that there was something yet remaining. Where is that to be found? That's to be found in Christ. And so there is the distinction and the emphasis that is made. Again, as you look at this idea of we've got it better than they did, why would you want to go back to find a rest that in its fulfillment was seen simply in crossing the Jordan River and inhabiting a land, when, in contrast, under the new covenant, under Jesus Christ, the rest that yet remains is eternity in the presence of God? It's best to stay with the new rather than going back to the old. That, again, is the argument that's being made. Okay? But I'm not exactly sure why I said it the way I said it. Problem is, you go to sleep and you wake up to a new day, and sometimes what you wrote the day before doesn't make much sense to you. So I kind of confused myself with that question. But that's the idea that I wanted to get out from questions 1 and 2. Yes, Dan?
Well, this rest
in
pain, this goes back to God
Yeah, I think that reference there in what Dick's alluding to is in verse 10. He who has entered his rest has himself also ceased from his works as God did from his. And you remember that, the creative work that God accomplished. He worked on 6 days. And on the seventh day, we're told he rested, which he ceased working. And the work was the work of creation. God no longer did that work. The work of creation was finished and complete. And of course, when we talk about entering into the rest is for the faithful. So what Dick said is accurate with regard to that. It's this rest is promised to those who are doing his will, but we're talking about the cessation of our lives. This is the end point. Ultimately, rest comes not during our lifetime. It has nothing to do with the physical land or possession of it. What we're basically saying is if we depend upon Christ and we live our lives as Christians, that when we die and finish, then there is an eternal rest that is ours, and it has reference then to heaven. And just as God finished, we're finished. It is appointed for man to die once, and after this, the judgment. All right, question number 3. Is there a firm distinction between soul and spirit, and does the term joints and marrow refer to the physical body? this goes back to our discussion of what is indicated in that discussion of the capabilities of the Word of God in verse 12, the ability to pierce to the division of soul and spirit and of joints and marrow and discern of the thoughts and intents of the heart. Were we able to ascertain any hard and fast rule with regard to definition, to where you can simply define this is what the soul is, this is what the spirit is, and that they are distinct from one another? Anybody want to tackle that any better than what we did already? I mean, the words are different, as we indicated, but they're used synonymously in numerous times through Scripture. And the idea here that I think the Hebrew writer is trying to get out is more with regard to the efficacy of God's Word and how that has the ability to judge the innermost thoughts and the innermost person, and it accomplishes that in the minds of men. So, with regard to joints and marrow, it's not referring to the physical body. We all agree on that. Okay. All right. Yeah, but I think again, of course, the indication is the work of the Spirit is spiritual in nature, and so where there is that distinction that is made between the outer man and the inward man, you even have in the fifth chapter of Galatians, you talk about the flesh and the spirit. The body without the spirit is dead, so faith being alone is dead also. There are a lot of passages which kind of indicate physical man and physical desires and such, and then the spiritual. And what he's referring to here is the innermost part of man, not necessarily, not talking about his blood and guts, in other words. It's having reference to those things that have eternal consequence, and that the spirit, that the sword of the spirit has the ability to discern in regard to those things. Okay, and then finally, there are five questions. So question number four, what does the phrase pass through the heavens mean? Somebody speak, please. Except for me and Dick. Yes. Okay, into heaven itself. Yeah, passing through the heavens, and we've made a reference to this as far as Paul's writings before, when he was caught up into the third heaven, having reference to the concept of heaven has a physical component when he's referring to the atmosphere or space, but Jesus has gone beyond that, and he is in the heaven of heavens. Yes. And again, you know, the language is somewhat figurative. And accommodated, because, you know, where's heaven? Okay, is heaven literally, physically located? Now, when you're talking about a spiritual place, how can you? But is it located outside of the universe? Well, yes, it is. But is it physically located outside? You're talking about something that really, it doesn't apply here, but as far as the language goes, it's somewhat accommodated to us. Now, having said that, it is kind of an interesting thing that when Jesus ascended into heaven, that his physical body was taken up into the clouds. So there was an actual, literal, physical ascension of Jesus' body up into the clouds. Now, you know, I have a hard time, and of course, if you were to have some Hollywood dramatic representation of it, you would see it's kind of like a spaceship going into warp drive, you know, to get Jesus outside of the universe and into the heaven of heavens. And that's beyond me. I'm not even going to try to speculate with regard to that. The transformation, and we shall appear, and we will go to heaven, and heaven is a true, real place, but it is something that's outside the bounds of this physical universe. And so I think we're kind of limited to that. Shouldn't speculate, but that's the idea, is that it's not, he didn't go up into the sky, he didn't go just up into space, he actually went to the place that is the abode of God. And then question number five, explain how that Jesus as a high priest in heaven, do what?
See, before we go to that one, what we talked about, you know, the copy
question 5. Explain how that Jesus is a high priest in heaven and tempted but sinless differs from the high priest that served under the old law. Okay, that we just talked about, so we can kind of just very quickly point out again, Christ sinless, the priests under Aaron sinful, they were fallible men. Christ in heaven, them in the temple or the tabernacle. Christ order, his place, his the offering of himself as the sacrifice, all of these things superior to that of the other priesthood. Anybody want to, anything else that I left out in regard to that we discussed? All right, well that's good. Then let us go over to chapter 5, Hebrews chapter 5. And as we get into a discussion of this chapter, we have a continuation of the idea of the priesthood of the high priest and of Christ serving as high priest. You'll notice in the first four verses there is a discussion of what it takes to be qualified to serve as a high priest, and then in verses 5 through 11 we are given an explanation as to why Jesus fills that position ably and he is qualified to serve. So in effect, what you're basically, and again, this is one of those times when the chapter break is actually somewhat unfortunate, because the actual beginning of a new thought is in chapter 4, verse 14. Not saying that thought doesn't coincide and add to the thoughts previous, but the idea of the discussion of the high priesthood is something that begins in verse 14. There's no real reason to break the chapter where they do, because as he talks about Jesus Christ as high priest, introduces that, the writer feels it necessary to defend his statement that Jesus Christ serves as high priest by giving the qualifications of high priest and why it is that Jesus indeed can serve in that capacity. So this is a continuation, very much a continuation of verses 14 through 16. He has made an assertion that Jesus Christ serves ably as our high priest, and because of that we can boldly go to the throne of grace. And then he backs that assertion up with this discussion of the qualifications. And so, again, just so that you'll recognize it, sometimes those chapter designations are rather arbitrary and even can be unfortunate, because they can, I guess, obscure what is a natural continuation of a narrative. And in fact, that's kind of seen from the first word in chapter 5, and that is for, which indicates he's building upon a previous point. But he says in verse 16, we can come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. For every high priest taken from among men is appointed for men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can have compassion on those who are ignorant and going astray, since he himself is also subject to weakness. Because of this, he is required, as for the people, so also for himself, to offer sacrifices for sins. And no man takes this honor to himself, but he who is called by God, just as Aaron was. Now, here he describes, in effect, how Jesus Christ can be the one that he has asserted to be in verses 14 through 16, and can accomplish what he has asserted to have accomplished in those verses. So how does it work? How is it that a high priest becomes a high priest, and what is the work that he does? Well, the first thing to note is you go down to the last part of that text, and that is that no man takes the honor to himself, but he who is called by God. So who is the high priest? It is the one who is chosen by God. Jesus Christ serves as high priest, as we'll see as we continue in this discussion, because God made him the choice. He is not usurping it. He's not taking upon himself. And again, this is something that would have some relevance to the Jew, as the Jew recognized, first of all, that the priestly tribe was Levitical, and that Jesus was of the tribe of Judah. So, okay, you're talking about Jesus Christ. We're not talking about Jesus as Lord and King now. We're talking about Jesus as high priest. Wait a second. High priests were Levites. So those who were called by God to be priests were of the Levitical tribe. How can you say Jesus Christ is a high priest? Well, his affirmation here, he's kind of jumping the gun with it, and, you know, answering their questions before they ask them, is yes, Jesus Christ is high priest. We'll explain why when he gets into verse 5, he does. But he wants to point this out, is that Jesus didn't take it upon himself. He didn't usurp this. He didn't arbitrarily say, okay, I'm going to be high priest. God called him to that position. God gave him that position. Then he describes in verses 5 and following how that is. So he's answering the question before the question is asked. And there are a number of places where the Apostle Paul, if indeed he wrote this, in Hebrews 5, as well as the Galatian epistle, Epistle to the Galatians, where he brings up that priesthood of Melchizedek, and we'll have opportunity to discuss that, how that Jesus, because he is king and priest under this new covenant, and it was necessary that there be a new covenant because it couldn't happen under the old, but it is accomplished for us that Jesus Christ serves both as priest and king by this new order. But he was called to it by God. So that's how you become high priest. God calls you to it. It's not something that you take upon yourself. It cannot be said that Jesus sought this and took it without authority. This is what God intended, and that's the point that he is first of all asserting and then proving as the text continues. But also, if you'll notice about this, things that the high priest does, what is accomplished. Starting verse 1, every high priest taken from among men, appointed for men in things pertaining to God. Now, what does that mean? It is appointed for men in things pertaining to God. Well, number of ways that we could describe it. Let me give you just one. You remember in Acts, the 6th chapter, in the infancy of the church, that there was a conflict that arose in Jerusalem. A lot of people had been baptized. A lot of people from other places that were displaced and living there in Jerusalem at the time. And as a result of that, there was a group of widows they were Grecian widows. In other words, they did not live in Judea, did not live in Jerusalem. And when the food was being doled out daily to the widows in the church, the Grecian widows were being neglected. And it caused a stir in the church. There were some of the Grecian Jews, those from that realm that had come to Jerusalem, were upset because their widows were being neglected. They weren't receiving the same amounts, or they weren't receiving the supplements as others were. And so they objected to it, brought that objection to the apostles. And the apostles' answer was, in effect, we're too busy doing spiritual work to be bothered with this. And so instead what we're going to do is appoint these men, and they will be given the responsibility to take care of this so that we can continue our labor in the work. And so in that text there is a distinction made between what are, in effect, secular or physical things and those things that are spiritual in nature, having reference to the preaching of the gospel and the teaching of the word. And the Bible makes those distinctions time and again. The priestly class was the clergy in the Old Covenant. They were an entire tribe that were given over to that purpose. You had the Levites, who were, in effect, the servants of the priests. And then you had the priests themselves, who were given over to this spiritual work. You'll remember, as a result of that, this being their inheritance or lot by God, it was incumbent upon the other tribes to tithe and give a tenth of their crops and how God had prospered them, for the purpose of caring for the priests, so they could give themselves over to that spiritual work. And that's basically the idea that is given here. When you look at that verse, and it says that the high priest, and again, you have the priest, and then you have the high priest. What does the high priest do? The high priest takes care of the things, the needful things, between man and God. These are the spiritual things. And of course, it has reference to specifically the offering of sacrifice. But that hierarchical need, the greatest of those needs, is in fact the spiritual. And this is a little bit somewhat maybe off the subject by means of application, but I cannot emphasized to a great an extent how important it is in our day, in our culture, to note that distinction and that difference, because the world's completely missed it. In my bulletin article, on the long article, I make note of the view that some people have, and it's becoming ever more prevalent, even in religious circles, that basically the spiritual is irrelevant, and what churches ought to be involved in is making life better on earth. And the idea, and this is very, very prevalent among modern theologians, we've gotten to the point in our culture and our understanding of the universe as evolved and there's a term that's just not coming to mind, sophisticated men, that we no longer are confused about superstitions and the idea of miracles and the idea of the existence of God, the idea of the resurrection of Jesus and his virgin birth and all the miracles performed. We recognize that those are fables. We recognize that they're not legitimate. We recognize that there is no God, really, that the earth was formed out of the Big Bang and over a process of millennia and millions of years, that there was this gradual evolution of human life, and that early in the history of mankind, he began superstitiously to look in the heavens for some being greater than himself. It gave him comfort, and we see all of that. And as a result of all that, there has developed a system of religion that is beneficial and helpful to man. It makes his life happier. The moral laws that have come out of such an appeal to authority are beneficial to mankind and have helped society in the past. But we've grown beyond that, and what we need to do is try to come to this point as a people to where we take those good things that have come out of religion, but we get rid of all of the superstitious trappings that go beyond that. And what these individuals basically are doing are seeking to secularize the church. They still want to have a church, but they want to have a church to where worship isn't important, to where surely adoration to this fictional God's not important, but rather these are social institutions that can change society in ways, be benevolent, be... It's like a civic organization is what they're trying to turn the church into. It's a social club. The social gospel is, in fact, an outgrowth of this modernistic theology. It's what we see in Churches of Christ that is a social gospel is basically just the end of the garment. It's very little as to what the theory completely is. But it's a socializing of the gospel rather than being a spiritual thing and concerned with concepts of sin and obedience to God and heaven and hell and condemnation and salvation. Those things are irrelevant. And our churches need to get past that and get onto something that actually will do some good. That's a very real feeling that many people who call themselves Christians actually have. And what he's indicating here, just in contrast, in verse 1, chapter 5, is that the work of the high priest has to do with the relationship that man sustains with God and how to get that to a point of reconciliation, to where man and God are on the same page and with one another. Now, who is it that's in charge of that part of Jewish life? The high priest. That's what his life is about. That's what he's centered on. That's his purpose. And it is as a result of that, and that purpose being that he, number one, needs compassion and can have. Well, first of all, number one is the latter part of verse 5. He offers gifts and sacrifices to God for sins. He has compassion, or must have compassion, because of the sins of mankind, because that's what he's seeking to do. But he can have compassion because he himself is subject to weakness. And again, we've already alluded to Jesus and how he feels that in verse 15, because he was tempted in all points like as we, yet without sin. But also, he says, under the old priesthood, he is required, as for the people, so also for himself, to offer sacrifices for sins. So this is where the old high priest isn't as good as the new high priest, because the old high priest himself was a sinner. And so when he offered up for himself as well as the people. But so this is the work of the high priest, what's needed there. Focused on the things of God. What's His work? His work is mediation, offering up of sacrifices. What is a physical, or what is a qualification of that? Compassion. And the second thing is that you must be called. So those are the things that are the constituent elements of the work of high priest and the person who it is to be. And in all of these cases, in every single one of these things, whether it be with regard to the work that Jesus did, which pertained to God, the sacrifice of Himself on the cross at Calvary, His ability to be compassionate because He was tempted in all points like as we are, the offering up of the sacrifice for the people for sins, in which there is a distinction because He did not offer up for Himself because He was sinless, but that makes the sacrifice efficacious because it was Himself that He offered up. And then finally, verse 4, that this was something that He received an appointment from God. It's not something He took upon Himself, but something that was given to Him by God. In all those cases, all the things that you had to have in order to be a high priest, Jesus had them. And that's the point made there. All right?
Yeah, so, these scriptures, the passage here is kind of contrasted on the top of the Bible. In 14, how Jesus passed through the heavens, and it's kind of contrasting that, where in Hebrews 9:24 it says, "For Christ is not entered the holy places made with hands, not being of the truths, but in heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us."
Okay. Well, we'll talk about the contrast more in our discussion next week. Verse 5 next week. Appreciate everyone's kind attention today.